Welcome, everyone, to our ongoing series on race and policing. We have a very special guest today, as all of our guests are, but I think you'll enjoy this particular guest. She doesn't call herself going undercover, but that's pretty much, she is a participant observer of police academies and police training. So I think you'll like it. But for now, I'd just like to introduce myself. I'm Mary Texera, immediate past professor of sociology at Cal State San Bernardino. And I'd like to pass it on to my colleague, Robbie Madrigal, who will do our land acknowledgement.
Thank you, Mary. I'd like to add my welcome. I'll go and do the land acknowledgement right now. We recognize that California State University San Bernardino sits on the territory and ancestral land of the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians. We recognize that every member of the California State University San Bernardino community has benefited and continues to benefit from the use and occupation of this land since the institution's founding in 1965. Consistent with our values of community and diversity, we have a responsibility to acknowledge and make visible the university's relationship to Native peoples. By offering this land acknowledgement, we affirm Indigenous sovereignty and will work to hold California State University San Bernardino more accountable to the needs of American Indian and Indigenous peoples. And now I'll pass it over to my colleague, Mike German.
Thanks. Hi, everyone. I'm Mike German. I'm a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School and formerly served 16 years as an FBI special agent. And now I'll introduce it, Matt.
Hi, my name is Matt Patino. I am an adjunct instructor of history at Crafton Hills College. I am also a former police officer here in Southern California. Today, we are very excited to have Dr. Samantha Simon from the University of Arizona, where she is an assistant professor in the School of Government and Public Policy, as well as the School of Sociology. She has just released a book called Before the Badge, How Academy Training Shapes Police Violence. She put to use her ethnographic and qualitative methods in her research, focusing here in the book on violence, gender, race, organizational inequality. As part of the book, she attended four different police training academies and examined the hiring process, the training process, and looked at all of those areas of her research. Her research has been supported by the National Science Foundation, Russell Sage Foundation, and the American Association of University Women, among others. And she has been published in top-tier peer-reviewed journals, such as Social Problems, Law and Society Review, Qualitative Sociology and Gender, and Gender, Work, and Organization. That's the last one. She has her bachelor's degree from the University of Pennsylvania and received her PhD in sociology from the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Simon, welcome.
Thank you all so much for the kind introductions and for the invitation to speak today. I'm very excited to be here. Again, yes, my name is Dr. Samantha Simon. I am an assistant professor in the School of Government and Public Policy, also the School of Sociology at the University of Arizona. I'm going to share my screen with a PowerPoint presentation. One moment. Okay. I assume everyone can see this, for I guess the panelists can respond. So I'm going to talk today about my book project. I'll keep my, you know, portion of this in terms of my talk to just about 10 or 15 minutes and then open up to Q&A. I'm very excited to, you know, hear questions that you guys have about the content, about the argument, or also about the methods, since, you know, ethnographic research is always, at least to me, quite interesting, and particularly with regards to the police is an interesting topic to talk about. So my book project, or just my book now, it's out, March 5th, it came out, I'm very excited about this, is called Before the Badge, How Academy Training Shapes Police Violence. So I wanted to just give you all a sense of how this project came to be, how this project was, you know, conceived. So this is a photo that I'm showing of fieldwork that I did on a different project with Dr. Harel Shapira, who is a professor in the sociology department at UT Austin as well. And I got involved in a project that he was working on, focused on civilian firearms ownership and also civilian firearms training. So he was doing ethnographic research about essentially how civilians are trained by these private organizations to think about their gun ownership, but also to embody gun ownership. So to learn how to physically shoot guns, physically carry guns. This was a point in time in the state of Texas. That's where this civilian gun ownership project was done, where the legal landscape was shifting a bit on open carry and also just on concealed carry of handguns in general. So I got involved in that project. I was doing, you know, this ethnographic field work, meaning I was participating in the process itself, taking these training classes alongside other civilians on how to shoot guns, how to hold guns, how to carry guns. I was part of a women's shooting club also as part of that project. And what I was finding as I was interviewing a lot of these instructors of these training workshops, some of these were focused on at the time you needed a license to carry, for example, so you needed to go through this, you know, very specific state mandated training to do that. And these instructors were very often either current police officers or retired police officers, kind of doing this as like a side gig. They enjoyed it. It was, you know, some extra income for them. And I was asking them a lot of questions about, you know, how they were training civilians to think about and to use violence, how that was related to conceptions of self-defense. And I really started to get curious about how this training that these officers, you know, were engaging in with civilians was the same or potentially different from how, you know, they were trained as police officers themselves. And also, you know, how it was either similar or different from training that new cadets were receiving at police academies. This was 2018, give or take. So this was, you know, a few years after Michael Brown was killed. This was a few years after the Ferguson uprisings. But the police were definitely still very much part of the news cycle. There were very, you know, high profile cases of people being killed by the police, in particular Black people, Black men being killed by the police. And, you know, I shared the, you know, intense concern and also interest in wanting to know why this kept happening, what was going on. And knowing what I knew about civilian training around violence, I felt very strongly that, you know, the socialization processes, the training process that was happening for officers was an important piece of the story. I didn't know what I would find necessarily at these academies, but I knew that the organizational socialization process was an important site that we needed to understand better if we were going to understand these patterns in police violence that were so persistent. So I went into this project really wanting to know how new officers were selected. So how did officers even get into the institution in the first place? What kinds of people were considered good fits? What processes were in place to evaluate who was a good fit? And then, you know, ultimately who made it in? And then also how were new officers trained once they got there? So once they were hired on into the institution, allowed in, what were they learning? What were they being trained to think about? How are their bodies, you know, being trained to use ultimately violence as part of their jobs? And in particular, around this question, I was also quite interested in the diversity initiatives that were certainly a hot topic, generally speaking, across different, you know, types of occupations, including, you know, in academia, but in particular in policing. Diversity, demographic diversity, compositional diversity was being pitched as a way to potentially curb patterns of racist police violence. So I was interested in how that was showing up in the hiring processes. And also de-escalation was sort of a new word that was being tossed around quite a bit. And I wanted to know, you know, how was de-escalation being conceptualized at these academies? What was its relationship with the use of force training? And so those were sort of sub questions that I had going in to this project. So this was already touched on a little bit, but my method, generally speaking, is ethnography. So I spent 1 year doing ethnographic field work at what ended up being four different police academies. That was not my original plan. However, as anyone who does ethnographic research probably knows, your original plan doesn't usually happen. So I ended up though at four different police academies. The amount of time I spent at each varied quite a bit, and my level of sort of embeddedness or ability to, you know, fully participate alongside cadets varied by department. But ultimately I spent a little bit over 600 hours, participating and observing in the hiring and training process at these academies. And I also conducted 40 interviews with officers. Two of those are with cadets who, either were fired or left the academy ultimately. So this is the book. Like I said, it came out March 5th. So if anyone, you know, wants to buy it, I do have a discount code through NYU Press, but you can buy it, you know, in many different places. And this is sort of the outline of the book. I'm of course not going to go through each of these chapters in any way, for today's talk anyway, but generally what I have tried to do in this book is to show the entire process really from when a person indicates interest, you know, on a department website that they want to apply to be a police officer. That process all the way through to graduation, what happens, who is conceptualized as a good fit that whole time from the time they get allowed in throughout the training process, how is that constantly being evaluated organizationally by these trainers, what kinds of worldviews are being, you know, encouraged, what kinds of worldviews do cadets need to align themselves with in order to make it. And then ultimately, I finished the book talking about my thoughts on the future of policing. For those of you who've made it to that last chapter in just a week since it's come out, you'll find that what I ultimately talk about is reductions in gun ownership generally. And also I ultimately introduce abolitionist frameworks as a way to think about the way or how we address harm as a society, and how that might not include our current version of policing. So generally, the processes that I outline in this book, I've separated sort of for ease here into three categories. So first, the selection of new cadets. Next, that socialization process that happens in the academy. And then last, what I'm calling sorting. So how it is that certain people make it to graduation and certain people don't, and kind of thinking through what the implications of that sorting process is. Again, I won't go into too much detail today on these processes, but just to give you kind of an overview of some of the arguments that I make in the book. In terms of selection, what I found, and this was from my field work where I watched the application process, the hiring process that included testing, like physical tests, written tests, interviews. I also went to a bunch of career fairs alongside officers and kind of watched to see who was interested, how they talked about it. And through that fieldwork and also through interviews with hiring officers, you know, I was kind of trying to suss out, like, who do you want to apply? And then once they apply, who do you want to then be an officer? Because officers would often talk to me about, you know, you can just tell if someone would be a good officer or not. And ultimately, I separate this into four areas that hiring officers were really looking for in applicants that they thought would be a good fit. So there was a certain personality type. There were certain, you know, correct motivations that were meant to be expressed by applicants as to why they wanted to be a police officer. There were certain political affiliations that, though perhaps not explicitly stated, were certainly hinted at. And also there was, you know, a need for applicants to express that they would be willing to engage in violence when required to. So to give you a sense, for example, of that last part in terms of violence, during the interviews that I watched, and this was consistent across the interviews that I watched of applicants, the hiring officers would ask applicants if they had ever been in a fight before, and if so, to explain what happened. And initially, I was really puzzled by the questioning. I've never been asked that in a job interview, and I didn't know what the right answer was supposed to be, particularly given sort of the political moment that, you know, we were in 2018. But the more I watched it and the more I talked with officers, the more it became very clear to me that they did want applicants to have been in a fight before. They didn't want necessarily the applicant to have egregiously initiated the fight, but they did want to know, you know, with some confidence that if faced with violence, that they would react, you know, physically and with violence in response. So that was, you know, part of that last part. In terms of personality, there were sort of, you know, different dimensions of this, including being responsible, being disciplined, being honest. These things, of course, were not as much performances of these qualities as they were, you know, inherent qualities to a certain person. Motivations included that you really had to say that you were doing this because you wanted to protect innocent people from bad guys. And politics were certainly came up both in the hiring process and then in the academy itself pretty often, in that there was a general assumption that everyone there was politically conservative or Republican, and that was a better fit for the institution. So next I talk about in the book the socialization processes that happen. I separate this into sort of ideologies as well as embodied processes. But generally my argument here is that cadets were really encouraged to approach policing from a warrior perspective. So this meant that at the academy, there were very, very firm boundaries built by academy instructors around, you know, in-group, meaning officers, and out-groups. The training officers really worked hard to establish different kinds of enemies to both the institution, to sort of organizational, institutional enemies, and also enemies that presented a potential actual physical threat to officers. Cadets were taught really to identify these physical threatening enemies using very gendered and racialized scripts. So of course, officers were not explicitly telling cadets to racially profile, but they would instead talk about profiling criminality and using very thinly veiled racially coded and gender coded language in doing that. And in general, cadets were, you know, really encouraged to adopt this warrior mentality, which meant hypervigilance, it meant hypersuspicion, and really being prepared at any moment to engage in violence. So lastly, the sorting process that I, you know, outline or describe at the end of the book, I talk about the process throughout the academy whereby cadets needed to demonstrate to their training officers that they were both competent in the use of violence and also willing, arguably eager, to use it when prompted. And this happened really through repeated practice of violence. So a lot of these, you know, skills is how they're referenced in the academy, were not, you know, didn't come naturally to folks. And so really it was through repeated practice of, for example, handcuffing, of doing certain takedowns, certain holds, even just issuing commands, like verbal control, were not natural necessarily, but were learned through physical practice. And also through pretty intense institutional disciplining, where, for example, trainers would be absolutely irate if cadets used not enough force in a certain scenario, but that just was not the case when, you know, cadets used too much. Of course, too much was not encouraged, but if there was a mistake to be made, that was certainly the preferred one. So that's, you know, sort of the general outline of the book. Again, I talk about selection, socialization, and sorting, ultimately to describe the socialization into state violence that happens at these academies. And at the end of the book, talk about, without, you know, making any kind of causal claims, some of the implications of this emphasis on violence that happens throughout this entire organizational process. So I'll stop there. I know I went to 20 minutes, and we can open it up for discussion, hopefully, and some questions.
So, Dr. Simon, like Mike said earlier, I've gone through the book and hit some of the highlight points. You did, near the end of the book, address some of the questions that you've received. Mm-hmm. And one question that jumped out at me, and it was a question that when I saw your book was coming up to be published, it was the first question that popped into my mind. Yeah. And that is, can't a lot of what we've seen be alleviated by hiring, quote, the right people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So are you asking me that question?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I wish, you know, and I say in the book, you know, that I understand why this is sort of an attractive answer to the question or the problem of police violence, this bad apple sort of framework of thinking about institutional problems. And I think this may be human nature, this may be a uniquely American, a uniquely appealing explanation for Americans. You know, we like to think that people have a lot of autonomy, that we make our own decisions, that things are meritocratic. So I understand, you know, why if we individualize this problem, it becomes so much more manageable. If we individualize it, then we can simply just detect these people who are, you know, overly violent, egregiously racist. And if we can just do that, then the problem goes away. And really what I'm trying to argue in this book is that this is such a deeply embedded organizational process, to the point that, I mean, I really do make the argument that, like, I don't think the way that they're currently structured, for example, the demographic diversity initiatives are going to make much of a difference, because this process of socialization into, you know, using state violence in the way that the police are, that they do, is so effective, to the point that people are, you know, they leave, or they are, you know, they resign, they're really kind of forced to resign. If they don't align themselves with these, you know, pretty violent worldviews, if they cannot, you know, go physically hands-on with someone during scenario-based training. So I think that organizations are really quite good at self-preservation, at adaptability. And so I wish that we could just, you know, highlight a couple officers and take them out. But I think it's a much more deeply embedded organizational problem.
So I went through the academy about 30 years before you did, and you mentioned in the book talking to an older police officer, especially when it came to de-escalation. And I noticed that his answer was sort of elusive, didn't really pin down what de-escalation means. And I recall being taught specific steps to de-escalation, and it almost sounded like, without betraying that warrior mentality, he wanted to say the right things. And it got me wondering, did you, or were you able to identify, or do you see a moment when this warrior mentality really took over and shifted in police work?
Like historically?
Yeah, historically.
I think that there's, you know, you can also tell me from your experience, you know, what you think about this. But my sense of sort of the history of policing is that there are kind of always, there are these punctuation marks throughout history where there's a swing to the left, swing to the right, where there is sort of a high profile instance of really egregious violence or brutality that creates, you know, a public uproar. Police are under pressure at that point to make some sort of adaptation, some sort of like reform. I mean, we can see these in commission reports, you know, that have happened since the 30s, where, you know, corruption, brutality are highlighted, reform suggestions are made typically by the commission. And then we see it again 50 years later in a new commission report. And when you read these, I mean, really the suggestions, the reform suggestions are like, it's a little eerie to read them, to be honest, because they're just so similar over the course of 100 years now, just about. So, I mean, the way that de-escalation was talked about by officers that I met at these academies was basically that this was a buzzword. One lieutenant poked fun at me and said, like, probably a sociologist came up with it, and that it did not describe any difference to the way that they had already been policing, that they were always trying to, you know, they were always attempting to de-escalate in certain ways. They would talk about, you know, parking a car, their, you know, patrol unit a couple of houses down so as not to sort of, you know, elicit panic in the people at the house that they were coming to, that they had all kinds of strategies for not using force when they didn't need to. And so de-escalation was really described as like a way to approach a situation politely. You don't need to go in yelling necessarily unless the situation warranted it. You know, they kind of always had that caveat. So be polite, but, you know, never, ever, ever prioritize de-escalation above officer safety. And in these de-escalation classes that I went to at the time, they were not state mandated yet, but these municipal departments had them. They were somewhere between 4 and 8 hours, depending on the department, versus dozens of hours of defensive tactics training. There was no test at the time. And I actually agreed with these officers that the concept of de-escalation was quite vague. It wasn't testable. You know, I couldn't really envision how they might evaluate it in a written exam, surely, in a physical exam. I'm not sure. They could have tried, I suppose, but it was vague. And I still don't have a handle on, when people ask for de-escalation, how that could be evaluated necessarily. So I agreed with them on the vagueness, but it was certainly not something that was taken very seriously, I would argue, or that was considered new or novel in any way by the officers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that vagueness in de-escalation kind of dovetails into the next thing that really struck me about the book. And you talked about during the selection process, a candidate's willingness to use violence, mm-hmm. as opposed to, well, violence is going to be the very last resort. Can you kind of expand on that a little bit, what you saw through the hiring process? And you mentioned it a little bit during the training process, you know, going overboard was quote unquote okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, this really showed up in the hiring process, in that question of like, have you been in a fight? And the instructors, when folks said no, and I outline a couple of examples of, you know, when someone said yes or somebody said no to this question, but when folks said no, they had never been in a physical fight before, the officers on the board who were interviewing them, was usually like three officers, give or take, and they would express so much anxiety about it, you know, like, okay, well, do you, like, you know, you will get punched in the face as part of this job. And we need to know that you're not gonna run away from that, that you're not gonna, you know, cower, you're not gonna curl up into a little ball. Like, can you stand your ground? And they would push it and push it. And like, for example, this, you know, one interviewee said, you know, I think I can, sure. And at the end of the interview, you know, he leaves and the board is talking and they express again, they bring it up again, which they usually debrief on any concerns they might have, you know, after the interview. And, you know, the sergeant leading the interview said something along the lines of, you know, he kept saying, I know I can stand my ground. And, you know, I think he's going to just curl up into a little ball. And she finished it, you know, this expression of anxiety by saying, you know, he's going to have to get angry. And at some point, like, prove it. It came up too with me, actually. Like, often mm-hmm. officers sort of assumed that I wanted to be a police officer after this. I think ethnographers talk about this a little bit, and I don't blame anyone for either not knowing or not being interested in what a dissertation is. That's fine. but I do think I was kind of read as a student at the time who was kind of like writing a paper and then wanted to be a police officer. So they would ask me, like, do you want to be a police officer? And I would say, oh, I don't think so. Like, I think I want to be a professor. But, you know, I don't think I'd be very good at this job. And I don't do very well under pressure. I'm a little bit more of like an anxious person. And I asked one of them, I like kind of flipped it on him. I was like, do you think I would be good at this? Because I'd spent a lot of time with this officer at that point. And he's like, well, have you been in a fight? And I was like, no, you know, like, no. And he was like, he's like, you're really good at talking to people, but I don't know. If you haven't been in a fight, like, I'm not sure. So it was really like this very important marker that there was this willingness, and that if violence was brought to you, you were willing to give it back.
Mike, you have a question.
Yeah, I have so many questions. There was so much about this, and Matt, thank you for bringing out a lot of these questions. But, you know, specifically because you were just talking about the perceived need to fight, it also seems that you saw some gendered questions in that, and particularly there was a vignette about a woman applicant who actually had been in training in jujitsu and even in competition in jujitsu, and yet that would seem to be discounted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So the gendered aspect of this was super interesting to me, particularly because going into this project, and then still now I see this all the time, where there's this assumption that there is an essential difference between men and women, is sort of the framing of this, and that women are inherently less violent, and as a result, hiring more women to be police officers will reduce violence generally, like police violence generally, and also have some sort of effect, although I've never understood necessarily the connector between hiring women and a reduction in racialized violence. However, what I really saw was that women are certainly positioned uniquely at the academy, because in this warrior framework, where police officers are heroes who are running towards danger to protect innocent and vulnerable people from evil or from bad guys, women are conceptualized in this very normative narrative as being the vulnerable, as being the innocent, especially white women in this like conception of this narrative. So when women then enter the academy to fulfill this role as a hero, as the person protecting, it caused some tension in this narrative that really like drives the like almost mythology of the institution or the organization. So yeah, women had trouble figuring out where they fit in this warrior framework to policing. And they, I kept seeing again and again, and I kept hearing from these women cadets that they were, almost set up to fail, and that they couldn't outperform men in tactics or in lifting too. Like if they did, it was, kind of disciplined in a group way, where people would make comments about it, or alternatively sort of discipline the man who had been outperformed by a woman using, very gendered, sexist language there. That happened with one woman who was really, really strong. Like you said, like had a background in jujitsu and was, very, very competent in tactics. And when she did this, they were always like, ooh, oh shit. It's like in the, among the class, and they'd make fun of the guy usually. So you couldn't really outperform men, but if you underperformed or didn't perform as well as men, then you were considered a liability. And, gender scholars have talked about this a lot in different kinds of male-dominated occupations where women are treated as tokens, sort of representatives for their entire gender. And women certainly described this, that they felt like they had to work twice as hard to just even, like, be recognized as competent in these things. So it was really quite tricky for them. But with that said, women are perfectly capable of completing the tactical training, of doing well in it, and of engaging in violence on behalf of the institution. And the empirical research that we have, to look at, does demographic diversity have an impact? Does it shape, can it reduce patterns in police violence? The story that research tells us is not a clear one. So some studies say, yeah, maybe like it does seem like more, women use force less often, or they use their firearms less often. And then other studies tell us, well, more gendered and racially diverse departments don't have, remarkably different rates or patterns in use of force. And then other studies tell us, well, that might all be true, but the leadership matters. So having particularly a racially diverse leadership structure. I don't even think we have a high enough N to evaluate if having women in high leadership positions in police departments, if we can even evaluate that. But leadership might matter in terms of rates of police violence. So it's a complicated story with how women fit in these institutions. It's not certainly not the same as it is for men, but they can and do succeed in the institution.
Mary, you have a question.
Like Mike, I've got many, many, many questions. However, Thank you so much, Dr. Thiemann, for this wonderful beginning of examining police departments from the inside out, I guess. And a couple of questions that just take a, you know, one word answer. I was in the police department for a number of years as a deputy sheriff, and I remember taking a test called the MMPI. I don't know if you've heard of that. It's the Minnesota Multiphasic Index, I think. Mm-hmm. Personality Index, you yeah. know, where, and it was mostly used to eliminate people. When you talk about sorting people, do they still use that? In your research, did you find that that was still being used?
I don't know that they were using that specific one, but they certainly do use a personality test at the beginning.
For everyone? Or
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Although, I mean, all of the testing, from what I could gather, is outsourced, of course. Like, the departments are not creating So when I would ask officers about it, there was a very limited understanding as to what exactly they were evaluating with any mm-hmm. of these written exams, mm-hmm. to be honest. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I thank you for that. And also, I found that there was the use of lie detector tests for certain candidates. Not everyone. Because I did my dissertation on Black women in policing, where I interviewed 50 Black women. And what one said especially stands out even after all these years is she was lived in Compton, a lot of gang activity around. And so in her interview, she was asked, do you know any gang members? Mm-hmm. And she said, no. And they concluded that that was ridiculous, that she must have known gang members. So they gave her this test and she failed the test based on that question. Probably because she was acquainted with gang members, and she fought it and won, but it was used to sort people out, mm-hmm. you know, to eliminate people rather than to keep people. And most of these women that I spoke with, when we talk about the de-escalation of violence, the one scenario where they said, definitely women are not as violent as men is if two of them rode together. Mm-hmm. If they somehow finagled their captain, their watch sergeant to put them together in cars, mm-hmm. no violence, de-escalation, talking their way through things. Mm-hmm. But with the men as a partner, a man as a partner, it was always, you know, get in there and bust some heads, you know. So I think it just in that very specialized situation, we do see a de-escalation of violence. And I think the studies bear that out. But it's like you suggest, it's really not enough. You've got to change the system. To just put it bluntly, the system just has to be changed and to not accept the violence. My last question. Mm-hmm. So you have, let's say, a nephew. Mm-hmm. And that nephew is 25 years old and kind of just trying to find his way. And he says to you, I want to be a cop. Mm-hmm. And what do you say to him?
Mm-hmm. Okay. These are great questions. Thank you so much. And also so interesting, both your, you know, your background and what your dissertation was on. I'd love to hear more about that. So the lie detector test, yes, they still use them. Yeah. Of course, there's very mixed evidence as to whether or not lie detector tests, what they can tell us and what they can't. And there is evidence to suggest that they are racially skewed, right? So it's as good as the evaluator, is my sense of it. Certainly not my area of expertise on lie detectors. However, they did still use them. Generally, they did not use them for everyone necessarily. They used them for folks who, throughout the process of the background investigation, so to get hired onto one of these departments, it's actually quite hard. So when, you know, we were talking about also this like bad apple argument, it's not as though these people aren't being vetted. These people are being vetted quite intensely. You know, they're filling out these 50-page background history statements where they're listing every employer they've ever had, all of their education background, everyone in their family, everyone they've ever been romantically involved with. You know, and then at the end, they still have to include, I think it was like 5 extra referrals who had not been mentioned anywhere else in this thing. They have to talk about their credit report, any, you know, any involvement, any contact with a police officer that they've ever had, all the other departments they're applying to. I mean, it's really an intense amount of information. It's extremely invasive. They'll do home visits sometimes. Officers told me about times they went to go unannounced, talk to these people's neighbors in other states, even if they had questions. So these were like really intense, you know, hiring processes. The lie detector was usually used if there was ever some kind of inconsistency that arose. An inconsistency was always perceived as dishonesty. So generally they would use the lie detector test to probe that issue. When I would talk to cadets though, they sort of would laugh about some of the lie detector test situations that they had been in. Most people apply to multiple departments because it's such a lengthy process. So, you know, one cadet, for example, who had been hired on to one of the departments that I studied talked about how he had gotten eliminated from another department because he was flagged for failing the question about arson during the lie detector test. And of course, he's laughing like, I haven't committed arson, like, you know. So, yeah, they were used. I would think that they're kind of used when a background investigator is insistent that this person is lying and they want to prove it with some sort of like scientific way. The two women in the patrol car, that's so interesting. That is so interesting. I haven't come across that particular, if there is a study like on that. I would assume that like, again, the N is so small on that kind of a thing. Since, you know, women still are just hovering at like 12% of the entire police force in the country. And that's really been quite a stagnant number since Title VII passed. So that would be an extremely interesting question to ask or to investigate more about, you know, the role of masculinity when men aren't present and what that might look like in the context of policing. So that's extremely interesting. And your if I had a nephew who wanted to be a police officer, I don't know. I sort of have the idea that I can't control other people in general. So I suppose if my nephew wanted to be a police officer, he or my niece or, you know, someone, they would go be a police officer.
But what would be your advice? What would be your comment?
I suppose I would want to know why. I would ask some questions about, you know, why they wanted to be a police officer. And I might, you know, issue a word of warning that, you know, once they get to the academy, you know, sort of the, if the reason they stated, which I'm going to assume it is, was something about helping people, I might steer them in another direction. I might talk to them about other ways that they might be able to help people that don't involve them also harming them. So nursing, teaching, social work, firefighting. I think I probably would steer them away from it. Yeah, if I'm honest.
I can't let you go without sharing a scenario. I was working in personnel at one time. So I interviewed probably hundreds of candidates to be cops. And we always asked hypothetical situation. Sure. You're in a bank, you're just a customer, someone comes in guns blazing to rob the bank. Mm-hmm. What do you do? And of course the answer is I would comply with the robbers and just take good information. I would get their description and so forth. And so, and that usually was the answer that most of the candidates gave us. And then one guy came in one day, and we asked him, and he was very slight, you know, but he was really gung-ho to be a cop. And so we asked him this question, and he literally stood up, and he pulled out his pretend weapon, and he said, "I tell him, freeze, or you're wallpaper." Mm-hmm. And that's an exact quote. And there were two other people who were interviewing along with us. And, you know, we had to quickly get him out of the room so we could just like fall on the floor because we were just so amused. And he didn't make it, you know. So I don't know if things are changing, or I'm wondering how that answer would be received in the departments that you studied.
Mm-hmm. I think it would probably be perceived as naive. As it sounds like it was for you. I will say that there were instances, and I outlined some of these in the book too, where departments were not trying to hire, you know, people who had records of egregious violence. So, you know, for example, it would not infrequently come up in a background investigation that there was intimate partner violence, a history of intimate partner violence, depending on what that looked like, who, you know, what everyone's stories were, that could certainly lead to someone being disqualified. Of course, any kind of criminal history. So if you have any, which was interesting, given that they did want you to be involved in a fight, but they didn't want you to have been arrested for a fight. They didn't want you to have, you know, an assault charge on your record. That would not have been good. There was a balance there. There was certainly a balance there where they didn't want someone who was like entirely out of control with violence. But they did want you to at least be willing to use it. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think it'd be read well, but I don't think that the reason it wouldn't be read well was because of the violence. I think it's because of the naivete of that.
Yeah. And to put yourself in danger, you know, Yeah. That's, so I've taken up enough of your time. Thank you so much for answering my questions. I was just chomping at the bit to get your answers, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Mary.
Robbie? Matt?
Thanks, Matt. Thank you, Dr. Simon, for these wonderful insights. We appreciate your taking time to share your research. Is it okay if we show an image from your book? It's the one of the white SUV that's smeared with blood.
Yeah.
I just have a question about it. And yeah, so you mentioned that I think you were at Rollingwood Academy, mm-hmm. and they were talking about defensive tactics, and they show this video, but it's taken out of context. An officer, I believe it was assistant deputy chief, was killed. But then you mentioned in the book that the deputy had killed himself. And I was wondering, did you ever ask them why they continue to use the video? And I'm just curious.
Yeah. So this photo is different. So there's a couple different things that they would show. So this is a photo of an ambush, though the details of it were not necessarily accurate in the way that it was presented. A video that they show very often was that of Deputy Kyle Dinkeller. Which one do you think you're referencing, or which one are you wanting to know more about, I suppose?
Yeah, it's this photo, the officer who committed suicide.
Yeah. Sorry, can you clarify just what your question? I'm so sorry, Robbie.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Did you ever ask them? Because it seems as though you mentioned
No, I didn't actually, because I didn't know that the information was incorrect until I started writing the book, actually.
Okay.
And so when I started to write about it, and I needed to go back and find the photo. I knew what it looked like. I knew that it was, you know, a Harris County Sheriff's deputy. So, you know, when I started to look back into it and kind of fact checking different scenarios, honestly, that they would talk about, in the class, the video of Kyle Dinkeller also came up a lot, though they wouldn't necessarily get the information as incorrect necessarily in that. And I'm interested in the what kinds of facts get gray and a little bit muddled in the retelling of these stories, and why. And of course, generally they end up veering towards, you know, that there's a higher risk for officers, like the misinformation generally skews towards, there is a very big risk, there's a very big threat. We need to remain vigilant, we need to remain suspicious. We need to be prepared for violence. But no, I didn't end up going back since I didn't even know it was incorrect until later.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. And just one more question. Could you share with the audience your observations of the multicultural class that was you mentioned in your book?
Yeah. So there were these classes and they had different names. And sometimes they changed the name every couple of years from like cultural competency to multiculturalism or diversity and sort of these different names. And the one I think you're referencing was taught by this, I think he was a lieutenant, either lieutenant or assistant chief, who would come back to the academy. He wasn't like part of the academy staff, but he just really liked teaching this class for some reason. And so he would come back. He did this every 10, or he did this for like 10 years, according to kind of how he described it. And they would talk about, essentially my argument in the book is that there was very thinly veiled, sometimes not at all veiled, racist language or concepts that were being put forward in these courses. So for example, in this class, the instructor talked about, you know, discrimination as in and of itself not necessarily being a bad thing, and that, for example, me liking a certain kind of food is me being discriminant, in that I have a preference for this kind of food. So discrimination is not necessarily a bad thing, but acting on it is. He, you know, would use language around immigration that was dehumanizing, and really just didn't present any of the concepts in a way that are used, by example, by social scientists, by sociologists. And there was also the sense repeatedly, both in that class and throughout the academy, that there was a parallel between like racial identity and identity as a police officer. And that there was this sense that there was this injustice and this irony around more liberal calls about, you know, discrimination in policing, that liberals were doing the very thing that they were, you know, being critical of by making sweeping statements about the police. So they would say, you know, these trainers and officers would say things like, you know, why is it okay that, you know, people can say things like all police officers cheat on their spouses, but you can't say that women don't know how to drive? Like, why is it that these stereotypes about the police are acceptable, but stereotypes about other people aren't? So there was this slippage in this really interesting way that police officers were, you know, talking about their identities as officers is almost like a racial or ethnic identity, or importantly, an unchangeable identity that was being persecuted by the public. And that was something that certainly, you know, came up in that class.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, Robbie, yeah, thank you.
Mike, you had another question?
Yes, thank you, Matt. I was very interested because I've seen this also in police training. Your discussion of threat perception, and particularly around this area of ambush, and you know, it going back to your discussion about de-escalation and how it might be difficult to put together a training that would properly explain it, but starting that training with a video of a police ambush probably isn't. We could all agree that that's probably not a good way to start de-escalation training, just as making racially insensitive statements during a multiculturalism training sort of sends the opposite message. But with threat perception, particularly, you have a whole section on ambushes. You know, I really picked up a part where you were talking about how you were being introduced to the group and you were being introduced to defensive tactics trainers who mm-hmm. otherwise you had not had a relationship with. And in later, once you develop that relationship, asking about their original perception of you. And one of them used the term hostile, which of course in law enforcement means that you are a threat.
Right.
I doubt he perceived you as a physical threat, but how the use of that term sort of sets up that us and them setup that you talk about.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this narrative of a war on cops existing was certainly like alive and well at the academies. There really was never empirical evidence, obviously, presented to support this argument. There really isn't any, at least that I have seen, to support that policing has gotten, you know, way more dangerous and that there's a pattern of that happening over time. If anything, policing is safer than it used to be for officers. As probably we all know, officers are much more likely to die in a car accident. So there is, you know, always this slippage or inconsistency where like officers almost never wear seatbelts, even though that is a much bigger threat to their life, statistically speaking. With that said, we all kind of do this. You know, I think there is sort of a tendency among human beings to overestimate very low chance, very high risk situations. I have a colleague who gives the example of, you know, if somebody chooses to drive instead of fly, not a good bet in general, right? But people still do it. But there definitely was this narrative over and over again. I talk about it in the book where I had this conversation with this corporal where he said, you know, policing is more dangerous than it's ever been. And I'm sort of pressing him on it a little bit, like, well, when are you comparing it to? And he's like, well, you know, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, you know, there was like a lot of tension between the police and the public in the 60s and 70s, wouldn't you say? And he, you know, really dug his heels in and responds something along the lines of, well, sure, but that was a movement. This isn't a movement. This is people who hate the police and are targeting them specifically. This is an anti-police movement in a way that it wasn't in the 60s and 70s, which of course is incorrect in so many ways. However, there certainly was the sense that the violence targeting police officers was intensifying, it was getting worse, and that cadets had to be, you know, have their eyes peeled for that. In terms of the own, you know, perception of me, yes, definitely. Like they, in the chapter titled Us Versus Them, which I had originally titled Us Versus Thems, because there's a lot of thems that are, you know, these outgroups. There were, you know, institutional threats. And at least initially, I was certainly grouped in with that, where I was perceived, maybe I'm a reporter, maybe I'm media, maybe command staff sent me. There were like some whispers about, did I come, you know, from command staff? So certainly there was some hesitation about my presence there. I also just look out of place. I'm like a small white woman and not, you know, particularly athletic. I wasn't wearing a uniform. So there were a lot of questions about like, who is this person? And they knew that I was a student. Usually they knew that. Usually they knew I lived in Austin. So they had some limited information to know enough that I could potentially be unfriendly. And they were not shy about that. Officers would often just ask me, are you pro or anti-cop? And so I sort of have to talk through that with them. And I was always honest with them about my answer to that. I wanted to continue my project. And also be honest. And so I would generally tell them that I thought they had a really hard job and that I wouldn't be good at it, that we asked too much of them, and that I have some pretty major issues with the institution. And honestly, that usually elicited a great conversation where they also had problems with the institution. They were different ones than the ones that I had. But, you know, we would talk through it that way.
So Dr. Simon, we're almost out of time, but we do have a question from the audience, and that is, does a diverse police force have an effect on police violence?
So it depends. So, you know, I was kind of mentioning this before, the research that we have on this paints a very complicated, unclear story where some studies say yes, some studies say no, some studies say it depends on what you're evaluating as sort of the outcome variable in terms of use of force. Are you talking about firearms use? Are you talking about shootings? Are you talking about use of force? This is then further complicated by the fact that we have no consistent or standardized way of evaluating or measuring use of force across departments, since there is no federal mandate to do this. So use of force data is a nightmare. So it's unclear if it does or not, and in what ways it does. And then sort of, as I mentioned before, perhaps leadership matters in a different way than, you know, the entire police force matters. So it's unclear, and we really don't have very many examples. There are a few departments where, for example, women would even come close to being half to even like evaluate this on a large scale. So it's sort of an ongoing question. Yeah.
Right, I think you. just as a last comment, Matt, just to piggyback on that last question, my hypothesis is that when you talk about a diverse, that means, you know, gender and all that, but you don't apply to these departments unless you are somehow sympathetic to their cause. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be influenced whether you like it or not. I mean, I've seen so many young men who were, you know, just really wanting to go out and help the community. And then 5 years down the line, you know, they're in restaurants and looking at the door because they don't, you know, they want to get the bad guys. And so I would say if that study were done, that no, it does not change the level of violence.
Thanks, Mary.
Well, thank you, Dr. Simon. We are just about out of time. So thank you very much. Do appreciate it. Highly suggest the book to the audience. It is a very entertaining read. So,
yeah, thank you. And thank you so much for all of your questions. This was a great conversation. So I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good luck with your career.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.